The administrator Megazone introduced her to, a short, solidly built woman with a bun of strawberry blonde hair, went by the name of Miss Claudia Montaigne, and was a thoroughly pleasant and kindly individual. She expressed the proper sympathies for Utina's tragic loss. Apparently, Utina learned, her family had very recently been wiped out in a spaceliner accident, leaving her utterly alone in the world. On top of the aforementioned mishap at her previous school, which had rendered the place unable to continue her education and destroyed the records of her career to date in the process. That was indeed quite tragic, almost equal to what had actually befallen her, and much easier to explain to a layperson like Miss Montaigne. Utina made the appropriate noises of thanks for the administrator's sympathy, which appeared to be as genuine as the story was false. It would have made Utina feel a little guilty, if what had really happened to her hadn't been just as bad. The test, administered there in Miss Montaigne's comfortable, homely appointed office on the first floor of the Daniels Hall dormitory, was tough, but nothing she hadn't seen, difficulty-wise, at Otori. Some of the subject matter was abstruse from her point of view, but So You've Just Arrived from a Parallel Dimension helped fill in some of the technological gaps, and Utina's knack for fudging things filled in the rest. Once finished, she sat in the armchair where she'd completed the test, fiddling with the handle of her suitcase, wondering what Megazone had pulled Miss Montaigne out into the hall to discuss with her. The door was too thick for her to hear much, just the murmur of voices. At one point she thought she heard Miss Montaigne, whose higher voice was easier to make out words in, say, "No, that's out of the question. After last year I simply couldn't." And a few moments later, after a short but urgent-sounding burble of Zoner's deep, indecipherable murmur, "I see your point." And then, after a bit more, "Very well." The door opened and Miss Montaigne re-entered. Zoner stayed in the hall, his hands folded in front of him, looking ever so slightly worried. "Congratulations, dear," said Miss Montaigne with a beaming smile. "You've passed your admissions examination. Not only passed, but qualified to enter as a second-year student. Welcome to the Institute." Utina stood up, gave a little bow, and said she was glad to be admitted. "And we're certainly glad to have you. Now, if you'll come with me, I'll show you around the campus a little, and then we can meet your roommate." Roommate? It hadn't even occurred to her that she'd have to have a roommate. This could be awkward. Outside the door, she paused and looked searchingly at Megazone. Then, in a hushed voice, so Miss Montaigne, who waited with a patient smile a bit farther up the hall, wouldn't hear, she tried one more time. "Who are you?" He smiled, made a quick little gesture, and tucked a card he hadn't been holding into the top pocket of her jacket. "If there's anything you want, anything at all, come to me," he told her. "I'll be your guardian angel." Then he turned and strode off, rounding the corner to the left and heading for the common area between Daniels and Morgan Halls, the place Utina had heard him call the Wedge. "Wait," she said, running after him, but when she turned the corner he was gone. Confused, she went back to Miss Montaigne, and they went for their walk around campus. It was a nice campus, not as big as Otori's, nor with as many striking features, but it was pretty, and most of the buildings had a pleasant feeling of oldness and serviceability to them. They were, Miss Montaigne informed her proudly, the only high school in the country with its own working nuclear fission research reactor, a real museum piece, living history right there in the basement of the Washburn Labs. Eventually, their tour concluded, the Dean of Student Life led her charge across the quad to Morgan Hall, the tall, rather boring brick dorm standing kitty-cornered against Daniels in the northeast corner of the quad. There they climbed to the fourth floor, and, as Utina stood with mounting uneasiness, Miss Montaigne knocked on a door about halfway down the hall on the right.
"Oh, Miss Montaigne, hello?"
came a soft, rather husky voice as the door was opened. From where she stood, against the wall off to the side, Utina couldn't see its owner. Miss Montaigne stepped into the room, and there was a brief, murmured conversation. Utrina wondered what the administrator was telling the hapless girl upon whom she was being foisted. Then Miss Montaigne stepped back out of the door and declared cheerfully, "It seems everything's settled. Come and meet your new roommate, dear." Taking a breath and squaring herself, Utrina stepped around the doorframe and paused in the doorway. The girl standing inside the room blinked at her as though surprised, and Utrina took the moment to take her in. She was a pleasant-looking girl, a bit shorter than Utrina, built trim but strong like a well-made sailboat, with clear skin and thick medium brown hair that tumbled down over her slim shoulders and behind her back with a very slight natural curl. She had an open face, a bit rounded, with a neat little nose and wide brown eyes, a couple of shades darker than her hair, behind big round rimless glasses. Pretty, but not beautiful, not in a reach-out-and-smack-you kind of way. Utrina envied her the flexibility that must give her. She could take a little time and care and probably make herself quite noticeable in formal clothes. Or she could not bother, as now, and settle into an easy anonymity in gray jeans and a school sweatshirt. Utrina didn't have that luxury, especially with her hair color, which, she had noticed in her tour of the campus, seemed to be even more unusual and striking here than back home. This girl's sweet-faced, calm carriage, the rather tentative air she had about her, as though she were not fully convinced that she was in fact pretty, rather reminded Utrina of someone else, but surprisingly not in a way that clawed the raw spot in her heart, just with a sort of comfortable familiarity. She thought she could probably like her new roommate, if only she didn't so desperately want to be elsewhere. "Caitlin Hutchins," said Miss Montaigne, gesturing, "meet Utrina Tenjo." Kate bowed. "I'm very pleased," she said. Miki considered this. "Doesn't sound so bad," he said. "I wonder who I'll end up rooming with." "Too bad whoever it is probably won't be as cute as your last roommate," Utrina told him. Then, at the slight falling and reddening of his face, "Oh, Miki, I'm sorry. That was a stupid thing to say." "It's okay," said Miki, trying for his brave smile again. "I just hope she'll be all right. She must be very upset that I've disappeared."
Who? Kate wondered.
"Kosue, my sister," Miki replied. "We're twins like Pris and Guy. We were estranged for a while, but lately we've been finding our old balance again."
Utrina sighed, her palm to her forehead, a pained look on her face.
"Man, even without trying, I screw things up for people."
"We're not back here again, are we?" said Miki with gentle irony. "You're starting to remind me of the way Miss Himemiya used to be, blaming yourself for things you couldn't help."
"I'll be all right, and so will Kosue. She's strong. She won't give up."
At Anthe's name, Utrina looked up, startled. Then she realized he was right and cracked a smile.
"Used to be, huh?"
"The last time I saw her," Miki replied with a grin, "she was standing tall. It was a wonderful thing to see."
"I bet," said Utrina, with a bit of wistful nostalgia. Then she collected herself, became a bit brisk by way of compensation, and said, "Well, look, come back to the W with Kate and me. We'll try and keep each other sane while we figure out what to do about our little problem."
Miki nodded.
"I'd say that's the best offer I'm likely to get," he said, still grinning.
"Oh, speaking of sane," said Utrina, reminded, "Kate, there's something I've been meaning to ask you."
Griffin sat and listened patiently as Caitlin and Utrina explained to him the situation as best they could. The tournament Utrina had fought in at her old school, its protocols and implications, the rather muddled, unsatisfactory way in which it had ended. They told him about Sayanji's sudden appearance at the W. He'd heard about that before, of course, but now it had added depth and some disturbing shadings, given the context of his previous encounters with Utrina. Utrina finished it up with a recounting her musings on the last morning, before Christmas Eve.
that she was going to have to find herself a weapon and get back into some kind of fighting trim, in case she should find herself confronted by further adversaries. He sat with his eyes closed in thought, and for a moment she wondered if he'd fallen asleep. Then they opened, looking straight at her, and he nodded pensively. "Probably a good idea," he said. "I'm not sure offhand what to do about a blade. From what you've told me of your fighting style, I doubt any of mine would suit you." She nodded. "That's all right. What I need from you is help with the other part. I'm out of practice. I need someone to train with. I hate to ask Miki after all he's been through. Last time I saw him back home, he was hoping to leave the duelist's life behind him. And Kate says she's willing, but not until you've had a chance to gauge me."
Griffin looked at Kate. "As journeywoman," he told her, "you're free to pursue any route you choose. You don't need me to approve of your sparring partners."
"I know," Kate replied, "but with our differing styles, I stand to learn and to teach, not merely to provide an opponent for sparring. Such a thing might not be proper for one of my stature."
Utina noticed that her way of speaking to him became much more formal when addressing this subject, which she found interesting and a little unnerving.
Griffin considered this, nodded again.
"Fair enough. You're right as far as it goes. You're not a master yet, so you have no business taking a student."
He smiled a little, glancing from one girl to the other. "But a collaboration of equals, enriching the styles of both, that's integral to the roots of the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu. Tetsuo Asagiri and Talar Kem were just such a pair, and look what they made together."
"Equals," Utina said, then gave a nervous laugh and a dismissive wave.
"Me and Kate? Nah, I'm untrained. Oh, I must have some talent," she admitted, "or I'd never have survived the tournament, but nobody ever taught me a thing except by example. I'm not in Kate's class."
Griffin smiled a bit more broadly. "Well, that's what Kate wants me to test," he said. "So if you're willing, why don't we do that?"
They stood in the backyard dojo, facing each other with Kate and Miki bearing witness off to the side, and Utina marveled at the change in him. In the house, in jeans and a t-shirt, he seemed like little more than what Zoner had called him several days before, a perpetual college student. A young, sturdily built man, cheerful and even-handed when dealing with his rambunctious brood, who still seemed more like his younger siblings than his children. In gi and hakama, standing in his dojo, he changed, became harder and a bit colder, his face serious, eyes intent. Utina actually felt a little intimidated by him.
"Listen carefully to what I'm about to say," he said, his tone uncompromising but not harsh. "Your life may depend on it. If you're taking this anything less than completely seriously, leave now, because you may be killed if you persist."
She looked back at him, squared herself, and nodded.
"I'm not going to try to teach you Katsujin Kenryu," Griffin told her. "We don't have anything like the time. Serious study of a Kenjutsu Ryu takes years of dedicated living. You would have to come and live here, attend one of the local schools, and spend most of your spare time here in this dojo, for at least the next 5 years, to achieve anything like the level of technical competence either of my two current students has, and the first year would be spent unlearning everything you already know."
"I know," he went on as she opened her mouth to repeat her earlier protest, "that you've had no formal training, but you survived and prevailed in a tournament against what sound like some very highly skilled opponents, and that means you learned something all the same. The ancient martial arts didn't appear out of nowhere, you know. They had to be invented by talented people through trial and error before they could be passed down. That's what you did. You're already a martial artist in your own right. I'm just going to try and see how advanced. But before we start, there are a few things you need to know. Katsujin Kenryu is a form of Kenjutsu, not Kendo. We don't wear armor here. We don't use shinai. Our test today will be conducted with bokuto, swords of solid hard wood. Make no mistake, these are dangerous weapons. Musashi Miyamoto killed many men with wood. If you or I miscalculate or lose control, either of us may do the other a serious injury. I'm prepared to accept that risk. Are you? Utina nodded. All my duels were fought with live steel, she said. I'm not afraid. Griffin considered and replied, Live steel, but non-lethal rules. That's the other thing I'm going to try to do for you today. All but the last of your duels, and that was interrupted, were fought for a non-lethal goal, the scattering of a flower. Dangerous, but not with deadly intent. That's all changed now. Your old schoolmate wasn't interested in a flower. He wanted your life, and Kate's when she involved herself. It's going to take a shift in your tactics to compensate for this change in your opponents. You're going to have to learn to defend your life, not your vest pocket, instantly, instinctively, and by any means necessary, or there's no point in engaging. You might as well run away, or start carrying a blaster.
I understand, said Utina.
Is that what you intend to wear for this? He asked.
It's what I'll most likely be wearing when a real fight finds me, she answered.
Fair enough, he said. It's just that it may be damaged.
I have others.
Griffin smiled a little. Then let's get this show on the road, he said, and charged. This was a little unusual for him. In a real fight, he almost never attacked first, preferring to let the enemy come to him. In this case, though, he was trying to show her how to protect herself from an aggressive foe, and that required him to play that role. So he did, and made for her at a dead run, his blade set. Utina gasped. He was so fast, and barely interposed her own before he would have taken her squarely in the chest, deflecting his strike so that his blade hissed across her upper arm. You would just have lost the use of your right arm, he told her, and whirled inside her guard, gently tapping her temple with his elbow. That would have knocked you down, probably out. This fight is already over. They regrouped. If you'd like to use some of our usual dojo etiquette, he said, we could bow between these clashes. It's not required, you're not really my student, but it helps to add a bit of punctuation to things. She gave him a dry little smile, still reeling mentally over how fast he had dispatched her, and bowed.
Yes, Griffin-sensei, she said.
He grinned. I guess it beats Mr. Hutchins, he said, and attacked again. This time she avoided his opening blow, knocking his blade aside with her own, then took a half-step back and launched her own counterattack. But, ignoring his displaced weapon entirely, he reached out with his free hand, grabbed a handful of her uniform jacket, and slung her to the floor, then stomped on the flat of her blade and laid his own against her throat. This isn't a Zorro movie, he noted. Your enemy's sword is not his only weapon, nor is yours yours. Then he pulled her to her feet, and they backed away and bowed again. Utina was starting to feel a little foolish at having instigated this. It was stupid. The man looked only a few years her senior, but he was over 400, and had studied the art he now practiced so effectively on her for more than 80 years. What had she expected, that she'd stand a chance against him? And he was going easy on her, too. The way he'd thrown her to the floor had been gentle, and he'd only told her that the elbow to the head would have stunned her, rather than actually stunning her with it. Actually, now that she thought about it, that made her a little angry. He came for her again, and she dodged his first swing entirely, swaying her body back from the arc of his blade, then coiling into a crouch and springing forward. Their weapons met with a ringing clack. Utina shoved Griffin's sword down and away, its point rapping against the dojo floor. He moved inside her guard again, overbalanced her, and shoved her away. She stumbled back, then countercharged. He slipped the strike, just as Kate had done to Sayanji, and as she passed him, his sword very gently touched her back, between her shoulder blades. Angrily, she whirled. "Don't treat me like a child," she said, "pulling your blows, pantomiming everything. How is that supposed to gauge how I can really stand up to punishment?" Griffin gazed back into her eyes for a moment. "Okay," he said. "You asked for it."
The next hour was painful for Caitlin and Miki to watch. Griffin abandoned the considerate posture he had been trying to take and shifted into his full sensei persona, hard, uncompromising, and painful. He drove Utena mercilessly around the dojo, battering her almost senseless as she tried his defenses again and again. His throws became bone-jarring, floor-shaking crashes, his blows full force and numbing. And yet, as he did all that to her, Utena got better. With the stakes raised, her prowess rose to the challenge. She got faster, her movements smoother, her counter-strikes stronger. Everything about her became swifter and surer, her eyes brighter, the set of her jaw more determined. She started scoring hits on him once in a while after the first half hour. Still, it wasn't enough. She showed remarkable endurance even holding up that long, but he still had the upper hand. He crossed her up on her next attack, drove his elbow into her sternum, and sent her reeling back, coughing. Then he whirled, his blade hissing through the air, heading straight for her neck. He knew he could stop it at the last possible instant, and for all her exhortations not to treat her like a child, he fully intended to, for this could be a death blow if he did not. But she needed to know that it was real. She saw it and threw herself backward. The very tip of Griffin's Bokuto just barely nicked her, raising a red line across her throat as she fell. She landed hard on her back, skidded several feet, then kicked her feet up and over, coming up into a crouch with the fight raised another notch in her eyes. "You'd be bleeding to death," Griffin told her, "if this were real. The cut wouldn't be deep, but it'd be enough to finish you in a minute or two." Utena raised her right hand to her throat, shock bleeding through the battle-ready gleam in her eyes, and he nodded. "At your old school you were only playing," Griffin went on. "Stay on the duelist's path now, and you'll soon learn how terrifying real duels can be." Something sparked behind Utena's eyes, and suddenly she was a bolt of lightning. For a fraction of an instant, she looked like someone else entirely. With his senses heightened for battle, Griffin could see her ki pulse and shift in that split second, blazing with a blue-white light that hadn't been there a moment ago. With a defiant scream, she crossed the distance between them in a heartbeat, and there was a tremendous sizzling flash. With a crash, Griffin was catapulted straight through the far wall of the dojo, in a cloud of shattered wood and shredded paper, splashing down in the steaming koi pond, trailing smoke behind him. Zoner, who had been ambling across the snowy rock garden at that very moment, paused with a bemused expression on his face, brushed a few droplets of hot water from his leather trench coat, and looked down into the water. Griffin was lying on the bottom of the pond, his feet protruding above the stone rim, looking up through the still rippling surface of the water at the cloudy sky, a look of composed astonishment on his face. He didn't seem to care that he was underwater. One of the koi swam past, dodging out of the way of a bubble of air that escaped from his mouth as he made some comment to himself. "Gracious me," he said to himself. "I think I like this girl. Yes, indeed I do." "Oh my God!" Utena's voice came from the dojo. Zoner turned to see her standing in the tatter-edged hole in the wall, her face stricken. "I killed Kate's dad!" she cried. Kay, attracted by the crash, put her head out the back door, then made a startled sound and trotted over to stand next to Zoner and look down into the pond at her husband's startled, contemplative face. Then she turned to Utena with a grin. "Nah, he'll be okay," she said. Kate and Miki crowded into the hole along with Utena, and then the three of them jumped down and rushed across to the pond. Now there were five people looking down at Griffin, who remained on the bottom, apparently unconcerned with his predicament, his face still surprised and thoughtful. After about a minute of this, Kay mused, "Maybe somebody ought to pull him out of the pond?" "Huh?" said Zoner. "Oh, right." Reaching out, he plunged his hand into the water. Griffin seemed to take notice of this, snapping out of his reverie, and raised his own right hand, clasping it. Zoner heaved, and up he came, streaming water and steaming in the cool air, shaking water out of his eyes.
"God!"
he said, paused blinking and coughing for a few seconds, and went on,
"Damn! What the hell was that?"
The front of his gi was charred on the upper left, about where his flower would have been had this been a rose duel. Streaks of soot rayed out from a stiff-edged black hole about an inch in diameter, squarely over his heart. He bent his left arm at the elbow and looked down at it. In his hand he still clutched the remains of his bokuto, which ended just above the tsuba, in a blackened stump. He'd managed to parry that last lightning-fast blow, for all the good it did him. Utena sputtered, trying to apologize so furiously that she couldn't actually get it out, her face a mask of appalled remorse. Griffin let her work at it, thoughtfully feeling at his left shoulder with his right hand. He mused. I think that's broken. He tried raising his elbow away from his side and grimaced. Oh, yeah, that's grinding in there. That's definitely broken. Utena dropped her char-edged bokuto in the snow and fell after it to her knees, bowing her head, finally able to get out the words. Oh my God, I'm so sorry, Mr. Hutchins, I didn't mean to— Easy, 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 he said, patting her on the shoulder with his good hand. Get up, relax. Let's go inside where it's warm. I'll put on something dry and we can talk about it. Calm down now, it's okay.
It's not okay, I broke your arm, I nearly drowned you, I—
You're gonna hyperventilate and pass out if you keep that up, said Kay helpfully. So, said Griffin from the comfort of warm, dry clothes in his favorite armchair. What was that?
I'm not sure, Utena replied, still shamefaced. It felt like something like that used to happen sometimes when I dueled. When I really needed help, a spirit would come and guide me.
Zoner nodded. You do have a hidden power.
I guess so.
Griffin mused over this for a few minutes. Well, it's quite remarkable, he said. But if you can't consciously control it, then you can't rely on it. We'll have to go again after lunch. You showed real promise there. I think by the end of the break we can have you back on a solid enough footing that you and Kate can train together without a problem, if you can keep from blowing her up, he added wryly.
But your arm, she said. Shouldn't you go to a hospital?
Nah, it's already knitting, he said. Be fine by this afternoon. It was, indeed, fine by afternoon, and Griffin and Utena were thus occupied for the rest of that afternoon. First, they had to spend an hour replacing the wall panel destroyed by Griffin's unscheduled commuter flight to the koi pond, and then they resumed where they'd left off. With the initial gauging out of the way, they didn't clash with the same frantic determination that had marked their first sparring match. Instead, they moved more carefully, feeling each other's styles and talents out. By 3, Griffin was content enough with what he'd learned of Utena to invite Kate to take part as well. By 5, the two girls were crossing blades without him, and he was sitting in the corner with Miki and the two robots, sipping tea and watching while Miki timed a bit of music. The robots, each armed with one of Lesser Mazinger's swords, mimicked the competition of their masters, often with comical results. Fighting against Caitlin was an interesting experience for Utena. Her fighting style, being a form of Kenjutsu, was similar to those of Sayonchi and Toga, whom Utena had fought a combined total of 6 times, so Kate wasn't coming totally out of left field. Still, Kenjutsu was not Kendo, and the two specific forms in question were more distant cousins still. It wasn't much like fighting either Sayonji or Toga, merely familiar enough to remind her of those days sometimes. Kate was faster than either of them, if not as powerful. Utena had a slight advantage as to reach, which was counteracted to some degree by her unfamiliarity with the balance and weight of the weapon she'd been loaned. Kate had an almost unnatural ability to sense danger and move away from it before it reached her. She avoided strikes she couldn't have seen, and sometimes fought with her eyes closed, which was a bit unnerving. She also fought silently, without any of Griffin's running commentary, except for the occasional explosive, inarticulate cry when she was putting a particular amount of energy into a strike or lunge. They fenced back and forth for an hour, and then Griffin got up and barked, "Enough!" Kate and Utena froze where they stood, lowered their weapons, and turned to face him.
Kate automatically bowed deeply. Utna, unaccustomed to doing so, failed in it for a second or so, then did the same. Griffin returned the gesture with an air of great satisfaction. "Good," he said. "Very good. Kate, you've improved since the last time I saw you." He looked a bit wistful. "Won't be long before I haven't anything more to teach you."
"I'll always learn from your example," she replied, bowing her head.
He smiled, crossed to his daughter, and gave her a hug, then stepped back so his gaze could take them both in again. "I'm satisfied," he told the two young women. "Caitlin, if you ever felt you needed it, you have my full permission to train with Utna, wherever and whenever you wish. I only ask that, when you do learn something new from her, you bring it home and teach it to me, and pass it on to your own students one day." He grinned. "That way, your partnership will enrich not only your lives, but mine, and Katsujin Kenryu into the bargain."
"Deal," said Kate. She turned to Utna. "Okay with you, partner?"
Utna smiled. "Absolutely," she replied, and then, as though testing out the word, "partner." The entrance panel slid open, and Yuri Daniels put her head in.
"Oh, you guys are still out here," she said.
"Yeah, but we're about done," said Griffin. "I figured we'd hit the pool, be in for dinner about 7.
"A pool party on Boxing Day. The height of decadence," said Yuri with mock disapproval. "You're turning this place into a regular Roman pleasure barge."
"Where's the birthday boy got to?" Griffin wondered, ignoring the mock barb.
"He and Larry are talking shop in the den," said Yuri with a roll of her eyes. "You know how they get. Cybernetics and me, the two great passions of their lives."
Griffin laughed.
"Ah, did he make it over after all? Does he have his sidekicks with him?
More introductions for Utna and Miki. They're going to have to take scorecards with them back to school to keep track of everybody they met over this break."
"I've been taking notes," said Miki. "Today is Zoner's birthday?" Utna asked.
"Yep, and tomorrow's Kay's," Griffin told her. "This is a busy week around here, celebration-wise."
"Mine's Wednesday," she said.
"No kidding. How old?"
15.
Griffin blinked, frowned thoughtfully, glanced at his watch, and then muttered to himself, "Yep, it's official. I'm elderly." Then, shaking off the fake discontentment, he said brightly, "Well, we'll just have to have another cake, then. And hey, yours will actually be able to get the right number of candles on. For all of ours, we have to color code.
The red ones are each 100 years.
Corwin and his mother joined the sparring party in their trip to the pool house. Perhaps because of the presence of both his parents, Corwin retained a remarkable degree of self-possession. After that, there was the birthday dinner for Zoner, who feigned disinterest. "After 200, it's all been done," he insisted, but was obviously pleased with the gesture of remembrance all the same. Utna and Miki were introduced to Dr. Larry Mann, a tall man in a dark suit who looked considerably more corporate than he acted. Like, apparently, all the men in this little cabal of immortal fun-seekers, he had another name he invited them to use. R-Type. Like most of them, men and women, he was a personage of some importance. In this case, an executive with Genom Corporation, which the two Sephirians gathered was a fairly large company in these parts, what with its ownership of the second-biggest building in town and all. Corwin was surprised to discover that Utina's birthday was impending. Surprised and a little alarmed, because after the efforts of Christmas, he was flat out of gift ideas. As it happened, though, she took care of that little problem for him. That evening, as he sat at his workbench in his underground shop, racking his brain for some attachment or improvement to tiny robo he could make, she knocked at the door, and he beckoned her in.
"Hey," she said, "how goes?"
"Oh, not bad," he replied.
"You?"
She smiled.
"Best Christmas week I ever had," she said.
"Did you talk to Dorothy?"
Corwin's face fell a little.
"Yeah, she's not interested."
"Well, of course she's not interested," Utna said, exasperated. "She never seems to be interested in anything.
You couldn't convince her to do it anyway? I couldn't try very hard, Corwin admitted. If I asked as anything other than the vaguest suggestion, then she'd end up going because I'd instructed her to. And that's not the point of the exercise, right?
Utina sighed. Yeah, I guess so. I guess maybe if you try again in a couple of days, maybe you can wear her down.
Dorothy doesn't wear down so easy, said Corwin wryly. But I'll try.
Okay, good. Keep me posted. I'm interested in how it comes out. I think I'd like to have her around school. I bet she'd be interesting if she didn't try so hard not to be.
Corwin grinned. She is. Sometimes I can get her talking, get her to forget the unfeeling robot act. It's cool. Rare, but cool.
Yeah, I bet it is.
Listen, I have a question. I'm not sure if you're the right person to ask, but maybe you'd know who I could ask if you aren't.
He swiveled, cocked his head attentively.
Shoot, he said.
Well, do you know anybody who can make swords?
Swords? Sure. What do you need one for?
You remember the old schoolmate of mine who tangled with Kate last week? I'm sure she told you about it.
Yeah, I remember. Wish I'd have been there.
Utina tried and failed to picture Corwin, wiry though he was, going up against Sionji and let it pass. No need to bruise his ego, especially when she was about to ask him for a favor.
Well, he might be back, and I want to be able to defend myself. That's why I was sparring with your father today. Kate and I will be training together when we go back to school, and I need a sword that suits me. I never fought with swords like the one your dad has.
He nodded. Wrong style, I understand. Did you have a favorite one back home?
Yeah, there was one I used all the time. I lost it a little before I had to leave the school,
Utina told him, not actually lying, but leaving out a hell of a lot.
I still miss it, though. No other weapon I've ever handled had its balance or precision. When I first got it, I wasn't anywhere near worthy of it. But by the end, it was like an extension of my own arm. I still feel incomplete without it.
Describe it, said Corwin.
Describe it, Corwin repeated. Tell me what it looked like, how it felt to hold it. Did it have a name?
Why? Names are very important for weapons, Corwin told her. Any weapon of significance will have a name.
Oh. Well, if it did have a name, I never learned it. I got it under kind of odd conditions.
That makes it harder. Well, tell me what it was like anyway, and I'll see what I can do.
Without really understanding why, she told him, describing at length the appearance, performance, and feeling of her lost blade. Corwin sat and took it all in, his eyes closed. When she'd finished, he sat thinking for a few minutes, then opened his eyes, picked up the pad of paper from the work table, and began to sketch furiously. Utina thought she saw the circular mark on his forehead flickering fitfully. After 10 minutes, he stopped, wiped his arm across his forehead, and turned the pad.
Something like this?
Not something like that. That, Utina replied. How did you do that?
He shrugged. It's a talent. My mother is weaponsmith to her people. She's taught me most of the arts. I won't try to duplicate this blade. All good swords, swords that are real weapons and not just toys, are unique. Copying this one would only give you something that you'd never be quite comfortable with, because it could never really be the one it resembles. But knowing what this was like will help me come up with something that should suit you nearly as well.
He grinned. It solves the what-should-I-make-you-for-your-birthday problem.
She regarded him for a long moment, remembering what she'd seen of his mother's arrival on the scene, the odd language he spoke, the light she thought she'd just seen.
Corwin, she asked slowly, please don't take this the wrong way, but are you human?
He looked up at her, slightly troubled, and said, Half. Does that,
bother you? No, no, Utrina insisted, shaking her head vigorously. Not at all, no. I was just wondering. You seem different somehow. You and your mother. Little things, hard to describe. You kind of remind me of home. What's the other half, if you don't mind my asking?
I don't mind, but you probably won't believe me.
Try me.
Okay. I'm half-human, on my father's side, obviously. Mom's a goddess.
Utrina chuckled.
She is beautiful, but that's not really a healthy attitude for a son to have.
No, literally. She's a real goddess. Skuld Ravenhair is the youngest daughter of Odin Winterbeard, the Allfather, ruler of all the Aesir and Vanir. Mom is the Norn of Tomorrow, the Norse goddess of the future. We live on Tomodachi most of the time, but we have a place in the Golden City of Asgard, too.
So, you're... what, a demigod? Asked Utrina, showing... feeling... no indication that she failed to believe what he'd just told her.
At the moment, I'm being trained for full godhood. In another year or so, I'm not sure exactly when, I'll be called upon to face my trial. If I succeed, I take a place in the pantheon of the Aesir.
And if you fail?
Then I probably die, Corwin replied matter-of-factly.
Utrina blinked.
Harsh, she said.
I'll be ready, said Corwin. Mom's the captain of the Valkyria. I've grown up learning to fight from all of them, from the time I came up to their knees. I'm the son of the Midgard Knight and she who builds tomorrow. Sometimes they call me the Cavalier of Two Worlds.
He nodded, repeating it as much to convince himself as her.
I'll be ready.
He brightened. Anyway, I won't have to worry about it for a while yet.
You know, said Utrina, regarding him thoughtfully, I have no idea whatsoever why I believe everything you just said. But I do.
She chuckled.
I think maybe my tolerance for weird stuff is going up exponentially over time.
So, if you're a demigod, I guess I ought to be more respectful, huh? Quit messing with your hair and being so familiar all the time. What do I call you? Sir Corwin? Lord Corwin? Your Grace?
He reddened. Don't do anything any different than you do now, he said. See, this is why I don't tell people what I am. The ones who don't think I'm some kind of nut always do stuff like that. I just want to be a regular guy.
Well, said Utrina, hopping down from the edge of the workbench, I don't know about that. I think maybe you're a little too special to be just regular.
She ruffled up his hair and trotted across the workshop, then turned at the door with her hands folded behind her and an impish grin on her face.
See you at dinner, Lord Corwin.
They both knew instinctively that she'd have the door shut and plenty of time for the wrench he tossed to bounce off it. Corwin shook his head, waiting for the burning in his cheeks to recede, then tried with utter futility to clear his thoughts before setting to work.
Special, huh?